Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, everyone? I hope you all had a wonderful weekend. As I mentioned last week, the popular Causal Modeling and Machine Learning course, hosted by TWIML featuring instructor Robert Osazuwa-Ness, is back. We've now held two sessions of this course and student feedback has been amazing. Students love the in-depth course content, assignments, and capstone projects, of course, but the number one observation has steadily been about Robert's weekly study group sessions and the one-on-one office hours that students have with him. You can use this course as an intro to causal modeling by just spending a few hours a week watching the course videos and attending the study group session, or really dig into the materials and assignments and develop cutting-edge skills in the field. Now, no promises, but a couple of former students have gone on to write academic research papers with Robert based on the materials they learned in this course. This morning, Robert and I held a great session about causal modeling and the course. If you're interested in the topic of causal modeling or considering the course, I really encourage you to check it out by visiting our course page at twimlai.com/causal. As you all know, we are super excited about TWIML Fest, our upcoming AI festival that is jam-packed with engaging, community-oriented, and community-driven content. We are on the lookout for TWIML Fest hosts who will help us create the event. As a host, you'll get to share your ideas, experiences, expertise, and passions with the TWIML community through a session that you propose and organize. So far, we've had a bunch of wonderful submissions, including an exploration into the impact that AI will have on the medical field, a quote-unquote rookie playbook for ML beginners, a code names challenge where AI-powered bots compete, and many more. There's still time to submit your session ideas by visiting twimlfest.com, but time is running out, so put together those great ideas and hit submit. And even if you're not ready to host, be sure to register for TWIML Fest today. The event takes place October 13th through 30th, is totally free, and your registration ensures that you'll be among the very first to hear about important updates, giveaways, and announcements. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am on the line with Mohamed Kojabash, Nikos Athanasiou, and Michael Black. They are with the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems, and we're here to talk about their most recent paper, a paper called Vibe that we will get into in more detail. But Mohamed, Nikos, and Michael, welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast.
Thanks.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. Let's start by having each of you share a little bit about your background and your role at the Max Planck Institute, and you know, what in your background led you to this work and what your general research interests are. Mohamed, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, sure. So I am Mohamed Kojabash. I'm currently a PhD student in Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems in Perceiving Systems Department, doing computer vision and graphics research. So I did my bachelor's in computer engineering in Istanbul Technical University in Turkey, and my master's in Middle East Technical University in Turkey again. So during my bachelor, I tried to explore different areas that is interesting for me, ranging from robotics, NLP, to computer vision and machine learning. I continued for a master's degree in computer vision and machine learning, and I started working on human pose estimation, which has broader implications and application areas in the community. And then I started doing a PhD again in the same topic.
Cool. Thank you. Nikos?
So hi, I'm Nikos Athanasiou. I'm also currently a PhD student at Max Planck Institute. I'm in my first year. So a little bit about my background. I completed my bachelor's and master's degree in computer engineering in Greece, in National Technical University. During the first year of my research, I started doing research basically on natural language processing, but then I wanted to combine natural language processing, machine learning with computer vision. So I started my PhD at Max Planck Institute. I'm currently working on motion understanding, decoding, and how we can combine motion and actions with language semantics. I would like to combine machine learning and mathematical modeling with human interactions. I think that's the most interesting part of the machine learning research. And that's why I followed the PhD degree and started last September.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. Michael?
Well, I'm Michael Black. I'm a director at the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems. And I've been working on problems in human motion estimation since the early 1990s. And I became interested in human motion because computers can't really understand us and be full partners with us until they understand our facial expressions, how we move, how we interact with the world. And I'm motivated by Aristotle, who said, to be ignorant of motion is to be ignorant of nature. And I think almost all my research focuses on how things move and trying to get computers to understand that motion. A little bit about my background. I lived all over the place, educated in the US and Canada. And before I came to Germany about 9 years ago, I was a professor at Brown University. And been in Germany since 2011 and came here to co-found this new Institute for Intelligent Systems that brings together scientists studying artificial intelligence and robotics and using techniques all the way from machine learning, like we're talking about here, to physical systems where they make new materials for soft robotics and so on. It's a very interdisciplinary and exciting field.
So, Mohammed, you mentioned that your area of interest is in pose estimation. And in fact, the paper that we'll be talking about, VIBE, which is short for Video Inference for Human Body Pose and Shape Estimation, is kind of in the direction of advancing pose estimation. Why don't you share a little bit about kind of the broader landscape of pose estimation and where your paper is hoping to contribute? I think we've, you know, folks in the audience have probably seen various images that come from pose estimation papers and tools that show kind of like a stick figure superimposed on a picture of a body. You know, what you're doing is a little different than that, in that you're doing kind of 3D pose estimation. Talk a little bit about the broad landscape that your paper fits into.
Sure. So basically, the pose estimation is the task to estimate human pose from images, videos, or any kind of sensory data. But in computer vision specifically, we tackle with the problem of estimating human pose from images and videos specifically. And we can define human pose in different kind of ways. Like, as you mentioned, one of them would be to estimate some key points. Like, these are some sparse set of key points only that can be the joint locations or some limb locations of the human bodies. Or we can also try to estimate the whole body, like in a more structured and structured manner, like a human body mesh. So these kind of representations have some kind of a hierarchy. So a sparse set of key points are really lacking to explain the real human body. So, and also we can estimate the 2D or 3D sparse set of key points. But when we proceed to more higher, richer representations like human body meshes, which can define the whole body, like the whole pose and shape, which has some richer information that explains the human body. So in this paper specifically, we try to estimate the whole body mesh, which is more explanatory than only a sparse set of key points. And also we tackle the problem in 3D space, which makes the problem more difficult to estimate from the images or videos only.
Great. And Nico, you mentioned that one of your interests is in applying vision to motion. Can you talk a little bit about the motion aspect of this and where that comes in?
So we are aiming directly to capture motion. So we are starting from a plain video, which are multiple images, a sequence of images. And from those images that we have, we detect the person in the video and we estimate it's his or her 3D pose and shape.
So many methods have looked at this problem, but the vast majority focus on single images. So estimating the human pose in one image. And a video is just a sequence of single images. So you could just apply those techniques one frame at a time. If you do that, you tend to get a jerky reconstruction that's not moving smoothly and naturally like a human would. And so one of the observations here is there's more information in the video sequence in the continuity of the motion. And if we can train the computer to exploit that by teaching it what it is to move like a human, then we can exploit information across a long video sequence and get better results than you would get by doing it frame by frame.
Mm-hmm. And as an example of the better nature of the results, you've got a great picture at the beginning of the paper that shows some areas where the current state-of-the-art method in a challenging video doesn't seem to track very well, whereas your method performs better. What is that kind of reference method that you looked at, and what's the data set that you are building your model with?
Well, the competing method is from one of our very good friends and colleagues, Anju Kanazawa, who actually did an internship in our institute. So it's a friendly competition for who's going to have the state of the art. Anju's amazing, and she's a professor at Berkeley. And she also extended one of these single frame methods over time, but in a different way. And one of the things that distinguishes our approach was actually inspired by something she did earlier, which is to use a discriminator that knows something about, it's trained to distinguish between fake human motions and real human motions. And to enable that, we exploited a data set that we made public back in the fall called Amass. And Amass is a data set of about 45 hours worth of human motion capture data that captures a wide range of how people move. And then we use that to teach the computer basically what is a good human motion and what isn't.
And when you say human motion capture, is this kind of regular video, or is this the kind of thing that we will often see with humans in like white suits with like the balls around them?
Yeah, the latter. It's there are many, this is commercial motion capture data with markers and infrared reflective lights and so on. So very much a lab setup. And many groups around the world have made small amounts of motion capture available. Every data set, though, is in a different format, and researchers were struggling to get enough data to train deep neural networks. As we all know, deep networks are great, and they can do a wonderful job, but they need a lot of data. They're data hungry. And so what we did was pull together a dozen different data sets and put them all into a single format, this representation of the human body we use called SMPL, S-M-P-L. And by unifying them all, it provides enough training data to really do something bigger.
Hmm. So, Mohammed, tell us a little bit about your kind of first steps in tackling this problem.
Sure. So the first step in general is to create a baseline for your method. So what we did in the first step is to create a model that can only predict some pose and shape from a video, without using any intricate or complicated architecture. So at that time, the first thing we try, so there is a method called human mesh recovery, which estimates a pose and shape from only a single image. And we try to extend this human mesh recovery to estimate a sequence of poses given a video using a recurrent neural network architecture. So a recurrent neural network is basically a type of neural network that lets you integrate some information from past frames or past data points. So we take each output of CNNs from human mesh recovery method, and we try to estimate the sequence of pauses from this recurrent neural network architecture. This was the first thing that we try to see how the model performs with the available data. And in the next step, we try to integrate AMAs using a generative adversarial network approach. So imagine we have this baseline method that produces some noisy or inaccurate estimations of the motion happening. And if we integrate a discriminator to the training stage, which tells if the predicted motion is plausible or similar to real life motion, then we can supervise this baseline method to produce better looking motions. And this is what we did in the final stages, where we introduced AMAS data set and the discriminator, which supervises this baseline generator we had.
So let's go back to the initial stage. You've got a CNN whose output you're feeding into an RNN. What part of the CNN are you feeding into the RNN? Is it kind of the output of a final classifier stage, or is it some earlier layer in the CNN that you're using as input to your RNN?
So let me first summarize the human mesh recovery architecture. So we have a CNN that extracts the image features, and then a regressor, which is a couple of NLP layers that estimates simple body pose and shape parameters. So the CNN part is fully convolution, a fully convolutional model. And so we get rid of the regressor part to train the vibe, and we only use the CNN part to extract the image features per frame. And we feed these image features to recurrent neural network we have.
You talked about the discriminator. Is the discriminator trained separately or kind of end-to-end as part of training the CNN?
Yeah, so actually the generator generates some predictions and we train the whole thing end-to-end. So the discriminator takes as inputs the generator's predictions of the pose and shape, and it takes also samples from AMAS. So AMAS is exactly what Michael previously explained as the unified motion dataset. So we use the discriminator to validate if the sequence of poses that we have is plausible. It can actually be a real human motion. So the discriminator's job is by taking those two different pose sequences to compare them and refine the generator's output sequence. So we train this whole thing end to end, and the discriminator takes the real fake samples from AMAS and our generator.
When I think about the, again, this picture that you created for me, Michael, with the, you know, the folks in suits with the balls that process and those images, I think of those as kind of fairly sparse points on the body that are being captured. And yet these models are, you know, they look to be like fairly high, you know, resolution, fairly fine grained. How does the model go from kind of this sparse motion capture to more robust looking mesh?
Yeah, great question. That's a whole nother paper. So indeed, when you capture in a motion capture lab, you'd get a bunch of sparse markers. And then the traditional method solves for a skeleton that explains those markers. Now, we replace that traditional solve with a different kind of solve. We actually take our 3D body model, this is the simple body model, and fit it to the marker data using a process called MOSH for motion and shape capture. And this was a paper that appeared at SIGGRAPH or SIGGRAPH Asia a few years ago, and does a really good job of taking sparse motion capture markers and fitting the most likely body surface that could explain them. It turns out that from 20 to 60 sparse markers on the body, you can really figure out what a person looks like. You can think about it as a very, very sparse 3D scan of the person. Mm-hmm. And with a powerful statistical model of the body, it's how body shape varies and how pose varies, you can fit a sequence of these very sparse markers and get out this kind of realistic detail that we can then use to train other methods.
Maybe, Mohammed, you can help me get to the like the core element of this paper that helps it perform beyond the previous method. What's kind of that kernel of contribution here, innovation here, that helps get to that incremental performance? And, you know, how did you arrive at that? Was that obvious, you know, in setting out at this project and you just kind of put the pieces in place and it all worked? Or was there a evolutionary process here that helped you arrive at the final architecture?
So the major contribution in this paper is this motion discriminator, which tells if the predicted sequences are fake or real.
Okay.
So this is the major contribution we have. And this is the one that we get the most improvement in the results. So actually it is quite, from the human mesh recovery paper from Angju Kanazawa, we already know that using this kind of a discriminator for single image pose estimation helps a lot to have plausible bodies. So, and we thought that intuitively this should help for a sequence of poses. And we already know that AMAS is a very large scale data set, which has different kind of motions, which happens in real time and performed by the real human actors. And this intuitive reason led us to create this architecture. So yeah, during the development phase, we had a lot of technical difficulties and we just get through them by doing like fine-grained experiments on which part improves which.
Yeah.
And this led us to the architecture we have.
What were some of those technical difficulties and the experiments that helped you overcome them?
Yeah, for example, tuning the we have this discriminator and generator, and we have this discriminator losses that tells if the sequence is real or fake, and also some other losses that tells the 2D joint locations and 3D joint locations of a given input video. So we had to tune these two kind of losses to agree on an optimal solution. This was one of the things that we really tackled.
Maybe it's worth telling the audience also that one of the problems here is we want to get 3D human poses in detail, and yet there's not much ground truth training data where you have video sequences with the true 3D human pose in correspondence. And there are large data sets of labeled 2D human poses, but not 3D. And so this is one way to combine sort of weak 2D information with very strong 3D information. They're not paired. So AMAS doesn't have any images. It's not associated with any real videos. But the discriminator learns what it is to be a motion. And then the generator learns how to go from images to 3D poses.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Actually, the high overview of the paper is we get the 2D data, we output some pose sequences, and then we use that huge data set AMAS that has various motions to refine those predictions to be able to not between the two sequences, one from AMAS and our generated sequence, the discriminator ideally should not distinguish between those two. So the discriminator should be 50% sure about which one is the real and which one is the fake.
And that's a great point. So the discriminator is operating purely in the motion domain. It doesn't know anything about images or, you know, the frames of the video. Mm-hmm. It's just answering the question, does this seem like the kind of motion that the human body does based on the AMAS data set? And the CNN and the other parts of the architecture are more focused on extracting motion from the video frames.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Cool. And so I think one of the points that you make early on in the paper is that the motion that, and even the examples that you give, it's not like normal motion. It's kind of complex motion that is not something that you see every day. Is that, was the MOS data set kind of curated to identify and include lots of examples of complex motion in it? Or is there something in the process that is kind of extrapolating to that kind of complex motion?
Okay, it's a good question. There's a mixture in there. There's a lot of mundane things like walking. It seems like in motion capture labs, people capture a lot of walking. But there are some data sets that are a little bit more extreme, have more interesting poses. And in fact, we captured something we call extreme poses, which we hired some gymnasts to come in and do basically the wildest things that the human body can do, just to really flesh out the space of what's possible. And there's one other thing that happens in motion capture a lot for video games. People often capture something like kicking a ball and turning left or turning right in very discrete movements. And so we have something called a transitions data set in there as well that captures people doing one movement and then transitioning to another movement. So this is, again, trying to expand. These transitions are things that you might not think to capture on your own, but are really part of a natural human behavior. So there's a mixture in there, and it's rich enough for this task.
Mm-hmm. Are there specific things that Mohammed or Nico, having worked with this data set for this particular task, jump out at you as, you know, I wish the data set had more of, you know, kind of category X, because it would help you build more robust models?
Yeah, basically that a MAS dataset has almost all of the available mocap data by different labs captured and in different conditions, but it doesn't have a lot of in the wild data. That's the thing that it's missing, the extreme poses and the in the wild kind of data. So someone doing extreme gymnastic exercises or having like motion without a constant pace and having different poses and like opening the hands or the feet extremely quickly or slowly. Or I mean, we could always benefit from more variation of extreme and quick or fast motions. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now that we are starting to have, you know, I'm thinking like sporting events that are captured with many cameras from lots of different angles. Does that ever able to take the place of motion capture types of information, or are we not kind of sophisticated enough to correlate all of that and produce the kind of data sets that kind of traditional motion capture is able to provide? Have you looked at that, Michael, at all?
Yeah, so let's come back to this idea that, you know, traditional motion captures a bunch of sparse points on the body, not very detailed. Right. With images, we've got thousands, hundreds of thousands of points on the body. Right? They just happen to be in 2D, but they are much richer in some sense. We have all this facial expression information, details of the hands, subtle motions of the body, breathing and so on. You can see all that in a video. So our hope is, you know, one day that motion capture from video will be more accurate and more detailed than motion capture from a traditional mocap system today. We're not there yet. This is a step in that direction. I think your intuition about combining multiple views is a good one, and it's something that we've looked at in the past and continue to look at. Can we combine multiple 2D views of a person and get, you know, really high quality output? I think the answer is yes. I haven't seen a system yet that competes with the most accurate mocap systems. But then the most accurate mocap systems, you know, cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and have, you know, dozens of cameras. I think if you built a video-based mocap system of sort of that sophistication, I think we might be getting close.
Mm-hmm. And does LiDAR types of systems, or like what we've seen with the Kinect, does that play into this as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We also work with Connect. The new Microsoft Connect for Azure allows you to put multiple Connects together, so you can actually have several of them looking at a person. That's a really promising direction for a lightweight, easy to set up system. We don't have anything to show yet, but
Cool. So Mohammed, again, kind of going back to this opening picture in the paper, you know, it's easy to see where your model is outperforming the traditional model and kind of eyeball the delta. How do you evaluate that performance more concretely and mathematically in the paper?
So we have several data sets that has ground truth 3D joint positions. And one of them is a data set called 3D Poses in the Wild. Again, that is developed in our group, in Perceiving Systems group. So this data set is captured in the wild. And there are some subjects wearing some IMU sensors on their body. And so these IMU sensors can be placed under the cloth, so it doesn't affect the image quality. And so you can get the 3D joint positions from those IMU sensors. And we the measure that the most prominent data set we try is this 3D PW, 3D People in the Wild data set. And so basically what we do is we take the sequences from the data set, produces our results and also the other methods results, and compare what is the distance between the ground truth joint positions and the predicted ground truth joint positions. And also there are some other indoor 3D data sets we also used. One of them is called Human 3.6M, and the other one is called MPI, Informatics 3D Human Pose Estimation Dataset.
The 3D Poses in the Wild data set, is that, you mentioned it uses a particular kind of sensor. Is that sensor and the kind of sparsity of that sensor similar to what you see in a mocap system, or is it, you know, somehow more dense? I'm curious about the relationship between the primary way you're comparing performance is based on kind of these sparse representations. I wonder if that leaves something to be desired or an opportunity in terms of the ability to kind of capture what's happening in complex motions with these sparse data points on the body.
Yeah, it's a good question. So we use their commercial mocap suit called from XSense. It uses these inertial measurement units. I think there's 10 or 12 on the body, but we don't just use that. We also use a camera tracking the people around, and we use 2D measurements about the joint locations in those images to precisely align the estimated 3D body pose with the images. And so we have a technique that fits, again, our simple SMPL body model to these multiple kinds of measurements, the IMU measurements and the 2D measurements. We also have to solve for the camera translation and rotation and things like that. But putting this all together gives reasonable, we don't call it ground truth, we call it reference data. We're a little careful about that. You know, it's not the same level as a motion capture lab, but you get the benefit of being outside in the wild with all the complex lighting and occlusion and things that go on in natural scenarios.
Okay.
It's a bit of a trade-off. It's the holy grail is to have perfect ground truth where you know every single bit of the motion with no crazy sensors to get in the way, outdoors in the wild, but it doesn't exist.
So Mohammed mentioned earlier, you know, this process of kind of experimenting and identifying, you know, things that didn't work with particular emphasis on the discriminator. Nikos, I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective, you know, if you can share another example of something that maybe you thought was going to work and didn't, and how you had to adjust the approach to accommodate it.
Yeah, the experimentation procedure was tough. But yeah, there are a few points. So we tried, one minor point was that we tried the difficult CNN feature extractors and that was a difficult part to experiment with, but we quickly converged to an optimal one. And the other one is that we decided to use a self-attention mechanism, which is like a major kind of a major contribution, because actually the self-attention mechanism is not so commonly used in 3D modeling or modeling of human motion. So we use the self-attention mechanism to get even better results on the discriminator part, which is basically, imagine that we are processing the human motion sequence and we are extracting some features using two GRU layers, which is a type of very recurrent neural network, as Mohammed said before. And instead of hard pulling or combining these features statically, we are using a weighted schema to combine those two, those features. So the features that we have for every pose in the sequence, we combine them as a weighted sum in order to amplify the contribution of most important frames of the sequence more for the discriminator's performance to improve. So that was two key technical difficulties that we have.
And were you able to develop any kind of intuition over why that worked and what the attention mechanism ended up attending over?
Yeah, we have made ablation experiments that we tested the self-attention mechanism. So we tried two different things. So instead of using self-attention, we're trying pulling the features in a static way. So concatenating the average and the max of the features and using that for the discriminator to decide whether the motion is fake or real. And we compared with that case with our case, and the performance seemed to improve. It didn't improve in such a margin that the results were extremely visible, but for sure attention pointed out the frames that they should be corrected in the pose sequence, and that they were the more plausible ones.
Yeah, when I think about the various pieces of the model that you've built here, you've got CNN, you've got an RNN, you've got this attention mechanism, you mentioned VAE in the paper. It seems like a lot of moving pieces, and I'm wondering how that kind of impacted the process, and also from a like computational perspective, if the training runs were very expensive, and you're also working with video, which is a lot of data. How was the process of working on this from a just computational perspective? Did that have a lot of impact on the way you approach things, Mohammed?
So surprisingly, the model we have, both in training time and testing time, is quite lightweight, even though we have lots of components. So the heaviest part in our model is the CNN feature extraction part. And what we do during training, we pre-compute the CNN features and we don't update this CNN module. And we only train the recurrent neural network. And since the number of parameters is quite low with the simple body representation, our neural network is quite lightweight. And So we don't use like very deep layers, only a couple of a stack of GRU layers is enough for us. And it wasn't that difficult for us to train the model. So actually during training time, for example, like in half an hour or in 1 hour, we can converge to a good solution since we use this already pre-computed CNN features. And during training time, we also get rid of the discriminator and we only use the generator part, and it makes the testing much faster.
Okay. And then what about from an inference perspective? How expensive is that?
Again, it is not quite expensive since we only have the CNN, which is ResNet 50 in our case, mm-hmm. which is again lightweight and it can run in real time in GPUs. And the GRU layer we add, it is not again that expensive. So in a commercial GPU, we can get almost real time speeds during inference.
Very cool. To maybe start to wrap things up, I'd love for each of you to kind of put this paper and work, maybe talk about the things that you're either your top lessons learned or the thing that you're most excited about with this paper and its contributions and kind of how you see it, you know, moving forward in your own research. Nikos, do you want to start us off with that?
Yeah, I can start. So I joined MPI in September, and I didn't know a lot of things for 3D human modeling. So, and this paper is a very good first experience. And I think one of the most important features of the paper is that it is clear. I mean, the contributions are clear. We use a lot of unpaired 3D data to refine 2D predictions. Actually, 2D predicted 2D predictions. Actually, 3D meshes that were predicted mostly from 2D key points, and our implementation converges fast. It can create high quality and state of the art data. The predictions are very high quality and state of the art, and also, one important thing is that we made all the code and data publicly available. We have detailed instructions for everyone, so it's pretty easy for anyone if he wants or she wants to run and use our model and methods. We have clear instructions to do it.
Great. Mohammed?
So it seems that Vibe is working quite well on the restricted data sets for evaluation we have. But in real life or in the wild videos, there are a lot of difficult situations, and human motion is quite difficult to model because humans are capable of doing lots of different kind of movements. And also in real life situations, we have objects and scenes around us. We have occlusions caused by, again, objects or other people. These kind of problems are still waiting to be tackled with. And we show with Vibe, we cannot perform well in some these kind of settings. And in the future, I mean, there are lots of things that we have to do to model human motion and also track and capture human motion from videos. And this is what I learned in the process. Even though we have the state-of-the-art model, we cannot solve even some basic scenarios still.
Great. Thank you. Michael?
Well, I'm really excited about this paper and where it's taken us, but I'm always thinking about the next thing. And humans don't move for no reason. They don't move in a vacuum. They move in the 3D world to solve tasks and to change that world, to have an influence on it. You cross the room to open the door. You open the door to move through it. You move through it to get to the next room. You're solving tasks all the time. And in solving those tasks, you're interacting with the environment. Even if you're interacting with another person, you're moving your face and you're gesturing in ways that try to have an influence on the other person, maybe without any contact, but you're still using your body to influence people or the world. And this work at the moment just treats the body in isolation. The body isn't embedded in the environment. The CNN doesn't really know anything about the environment. It's a single person not interacting with other people. I think there's a tremendous amount we still have to do to get computers to really understand us. And that those next steps will be about human-human interaction and about human-object, human-scene interaction.
Great. Well, Mohammed, Nikos, Michael, thanks so much for taking the time to share with us your paper and what you're up to.
Thanks a lot. Thanks.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. To learn more about today's guest or the topics mentioned in this interview, visit twimmelai.com. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.